Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Lyricord Early and Classical Show, our regular podcast about early and classical music on Lyricord. I'm Nick Fritsch of Lyricord Discs, and my co-host is Jeffrey Dooley.
Hi, Nick. It's great to be here.
Once again, we're going to explore some very interesting early music on the Lyricord label. When news of the passing of the great lutenist Joseph Iadone at the age of 89 was released on April 20th, 2004, it created a flood of interest in this pioneering American master. Benjamin Ivory wrote a moving tribute to him on the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times also carried a tribute. Yet from the time he first switched from playing stand-up bass to lute over 60 years ago until the day in 2003 that he finally donated his lutes to his beloved Yale University, Joseph Iadone was ever a humble and soft-spoken man who brought the thrill of music and music-making, particularly Renaissance music-making, to the hearts of countless fans and students. Remarkably, he was primarily self-taught and studied Elizabethan techniques he found in his own research of historical treatises and manuscripts. Jeffrey, when did you first become aware of Joseph Iadone?
I never met him, but I knew his name from the beginning, and knew his wife, Susan Iadone, is a gamba player, a well-known gamba player in New York, and I didn't connect the two until someone said, oh yeah, that was Joe's wife.
Uh-huh. Well, Joe was also one of the founding members of the New York Pro Musica.
That's right.
About that?
Yes,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we have two of the recordings he made with countertenor Russell Oberlin. But he didn't record a lot, except with the Pro Musica. And he did a fair amount of concertizing in the 50s and early 60s. And then I think he kind of stopped, right?
I think so. I think he did. And he became a researcher as well as a performer.
Right.
He was a very private person.
Mm-hmm.
And this is often the case of people who are autodidacts, that funny word.
Right.
Self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I'm a little bit that way myself.
Right.
Because when you discover something, you may be encouraged by someone like he was from Hindemith. But then Hindemith encouraged him to pursue on his own.
Right.
Which many of us at that time did. Now we're fortunate to go to a school and have teachers that already know this, and people can learn techniques, early techniques, without having to be a pioneer.
Exactly.
So we owe him as a pioneer of the lute in America.
He went to Yale before graduating grammar school, which was,
Isn't that amazing?
The only person who's ever done that. He was a member of Yale's Collegium Musicum, which was the first group to perform early music on historical instruments from the collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And he collaborated with the instrument department's director, Dr. Emanuel Winternitz. He was a protege, of course, of Hindemith. And he was just a towering figure in the early years of the American early music movement.
There are so many artists who benefited by him. Lucy Cross, who was also an early player in the movement.
Martha Bixler was someone who performed with him a fair amount, and several people on Lyricord were his students. Everyone I've ever talked to who was his student said he was just an amazing person, and they all have very personal, really wonderful stories about him, and obviously he was a very big influence on people, both personally and musically.
And he was one of the people who talked about the fact that so much music was played too slowly. It was often the case when early music was growing into popularity, people were cautious. But then it went through a phase where things were going too fast, and that's now we're slowed down. Now we're at perfect time.
He was definitely on the too fast side. What was it? Someone said there's fast, very fast, and Joseph Iadone.
Yes, I've heard that.
Right. But on this album, Joseph Iadone, The Art of the Lute, we have several quotes from people. Wayne Hankin, a member of the New York Ensemble for Early Music, said he was one of the strongest musical personalities ever in mine or anyone else's life. He proposed a strict work ethic for me to go by. Any performance was nothing less than intense, and he always encouraged me to play it better and faster every time I played. Oh, many people. David Karp, John LaBarbera, the guitarist, Russell Oberlin calls him a consummate musician who was always an inspiration to work with. Joseph Iadone plays the lute with a distinctive, authoritative, and authentic Renaissance style. That was another thing. He played with the flat of his fingers rather than using a plectrum.
Oh, yeah, and his nails.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I know that's an issue, isn't it?
Right. He was very... He was very strongly of the opinion that that was the true Elizabethan style of flute playing. And it's just remarkable that he was self-taught. Let's listen to a little bit of The Art of the Lute. We will listen first to Louis Malan, Three Pavans. Louis Malan, 1500 through 1561. Three Pavans performed by Joseph Iadon. You notice he didn't mind leaving squeaks in.
Yes, as we were listening, I was thinking that. He didn't bother to conceal it.
Yeah, he was very firm in that opinion. At one point, I think I discussed, well, maybe we could suppress them a little bit.
No,
that's all part of it. All part of the, he was a real purist in
that
sense.
Yes, he was. And it's really unavoidable, especially since the strings that he used were wound strings.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have more noise when the finger slides over them.
Right.
Some lutenists used Michael Schaffer, died fairly recently. And his instrument, I think, didn't have wound strings because you could hear the fingers sliding, but it wasn't that sort of whoosh sound.
Yes. Well, on Art of the Lute, Joe played solo pieces. Then he also played duets, and he played trios and quartets, and he played them all with himself. He had a home studio, which I think one of his students had set him up with. And it was kind of perfect in a way for a sort of a reclusive soul as he was to
create
a whole lute orchestra.
All by himself, yes.
But it works very
well. That's what rock singers
do. Sure, sure. But he was doing it pretty early. And it's not something that early musicians often do.
Not often, no.
Well, let's hear a duet. Orlando de Lasso, who lived 1532-1594. So we're still clearly in the Renaissance. And this will be a Fantasia.
Lasso was an interesting character because he was abducted as a boy.
Oh, yes?
From the cathedral, which he sang for the glory of his voice.
Uh-huh.
He was literally abducted. And smuggled into, I don't know what the cathedral was, but it's a famous story about him as this boy. He was such a wonderful treble that he was abducted and taken to another cathedral.
I didn't know that. So let's hear Fantasia, and actually then let's hear Thomas Morley, La Rondinella, both duets with Joseph Iodone playing both parts. Was Orlando de Lasso, Fantasia, and Thomas Morley, La Rondinella, two duets with both parts played by Joe Iadone. The lute itself is a of course a beautiful sonorous instrument.
Yes, it was the standard home instrument like the modern piano today. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a piano at home. It's very common. Well, the lute was the home instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone
right.
learned how to play it. That and the viola da gamba both. Mm-hmm. And so the lute was considered the queen of instruments.
Ah.
As the organ was called the king of instruments.
Oh, I see.
And it was in many sizes. Many people don't realize that there's a court, a family of lutes, a
right.
consort of lutes, like there are recorders or gambas.
Mm-hmm.
There's a treble lute, and then as you move on in time to around 1600, Italy invents the chitarrone or the arched lute, mm-hmm. which is the longest lute,
yes.
for playing continuo.
Now, those have sympathetic strings?
They have sympathetic strings mm-hmm. on the side, and they're very tall, so the bass lines can
yes.
be played
right.
for continuo. But the lute was the main instrument, as the piano is today.
Right, and of course it's always thought of as the instrument of the troubadours.
That's right. Right.
All right. Joe Iadone also, on Lyricord, accompanied Russell Oberlin, and I'd like to play a little bit of John Dowland lute songs. Joe, play some solo pieces on here as well. Sempre Dulans, a lute solo. And then also, so we can hear what he sounds like when he was accompanying countertenor Russell Oberlin, Lady, If You Spite Me, and they're both by John Dowland.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a break, and then we can come back and play some more, okay?
Very good.
The first four volumes of J.S. Bach's Keyboard Works performed on clavichord by Richard Traeger are available on the Lyricord Early Music series. Peter Graham Wolf of Musical Pointers exclaims, "This is a revelatory ongoing series which establishes the suitability of that quiet instrument for playing and listening to Bach's solo keyboard music." Bridget Cunningham of Harpsichord and Fortepiano calls these recordings fantastic and a must for lovers of the clavichord and J.S. Bach. Robert Haskins, American Record Guide, says of Volume 2, "Traeger's recording of Bach's toccatas is special, extremely moving, and completely indispensable." Volume 3 ranked the highest-rated recording of Bach's inventions by BBC's Andrew McGregor. And the 2009 Penguin Guide to Classical Music says of Volume 4, "Brilliant performances, all of which sound very different from harpsichord or piano performances, and engagingly so." Jeffrey Lipscomb of Fanfare, "Path-breaking clavichord, warmly recommended." Jan Hanford of the J.S. Bach homepage calls Volume 4 a unique and sublime performance of the Art of Fugue. "Richard Traeger is a world-class musician. I believe all of his recordings belong in every Bach lover's collection." And Francis Knights of Clavichord International agrees, "This series is proving an essential purchase for J.S. Bach devotees." Experience all of Richard Traeger's Bach on clavichord recordings on CD or download at www.lyricord.com today.
I'm back here talking with Jeffrey Dooley on the Lyricord Early and Classical Music Podcast. "Come Kiss Me Sweet and Kill Me."
Yes.
Down and being...
He's down and up at the same time, isn't he?
But he spends some time on the darker sides of relationships.
Semper Dolens.
Right. And that was "Lady If You So Spite Me." And prior to that, we heard "Semper Dolens." Joseph Iodone sounding very plucky on the lute. Sort of, he has the lute stop on the lute.
The lute stop on the lute, yes.
To him, the rhythmic aspect of interpretation was extremely important. So I think he was very conscious of.
He was conscious of it,
and
you
articulation
can hear
and,
that by that recording, you can hear that he also is able to give and take with the singer. mm-hmm. which, of course, that's the art of it, too.
Right.
Singers of that time sang usually with a lute accompaniment, and mm-hmm. that's sort of like the high point. And you can hear by this that Iodone and Russell worked together a lot. You can hear right. that exchange.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a good accompanist in a German lead.
Now, as you were saying earlier, that the Lacrimae...
Oh, the Lacrimae Pavande, yes. Flow My Tears, that became one of the most well-known themes, and so many composers used it. There are variations on it by so many. There's a Caccini mm-hmm. setting of the Lacrimae, and the Lacrimae is the song, Flow My Tears mm-hmm. Down, such a famous tune.
Right.
And every composer used it. There's a bird setting. There's so many settings of it. Instrumental variations on mm-hmm. the Lacrimae. So to hear Dowland, for perhaps people who've never heard too much of this music, it's almost like the required piece. You
right,
always
sure.
do the Lacrimae. And it's also in Dowland's set of gamba pieces called the Seven Tears, the Lacrimae or Seven Tears, which is seven sets of variations on Flow My Tears.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, let's hear Joseph Iodone performing the Lacrimae Antique Pavane.
Thank you.
That is so beautiful.
It is. It's wonderful. Some of it's written out, but a great artist adds to what's written out.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the notes are printed on the page, but it's the way he executes those pitches away from the tempo, out of the tempo, gathering up the tempo.
And it's very hard to tell what's written and what isn't, because it's all just...
Yes, it seems completely improvised, which that was always the ideal,
right,
that everything would sound improvised.
Mm-hmm.
And music was not written with a lot of written out ornamentation, but this is definitely Dowland's own writing. And then Iodone is adding to how he wrote it, by the way he lingers here and there.
In the style of a true Elizabethan lutenist.
Right, definitely.
All right, well, let's hear a few trios and maybe a quartet or two. You don't hear too many four lute players getting together
very
on a
rarely.
Recording in any case, let alone them all being the same performer.
You hear more of that in Italian music.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Consorts of lutes.
Right.
Of different sizes.
Well, here's a Dufay arrangement of Credo in Unum Deum.
So this is an arrangement of a choral work,
vocal
work.
Right.
And a lot of early instrumental music is simply instrumentating vocal music. By that time, there hadn't been a separation yet.
Right.
Dowland, of course, is later.
Right.
So there is a more instrumental sound. Even though many of Dowland's songs were originally instrumental pieces.
Right.
And then he wrote the text later, which is always a surprise to people. But this is definitely part of probably a four-part. Four parts was considered the ideal in the affections. The four-part was the ideal writing, especially in the 15th, 16th century.
And he certainly speeds it up a little bit.
Yes,
there.
And sure is adding to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let's listen to Dufay's Credo in Unum Deum. He takes that to a whole different level. Certainly a different piece than it started out.
It's like a set of variations. And it's a sign of a true virtuoso that it sounds effortless. And, of course, a great deal of effort goes into sounding effortless.
Right. But you're not supposed to hear it.
No. If it's full of effort, you know the person hasn't worked hard enough.
Right.
Obviously, Joe worked.
Right. Let's listen to Heinrich Isaac. Helas que devara mon cuar. And also, coupled with that, we'll play some Josquin Dupré, De Tous Blen Plain. Jeffrey said this is so often the kind of thing that doesn't work.
Yes.
An arrangement like that. You know, it's very ambitious.
And you have to be comfortable with the technique in order to make it work.
Right. So we've covered a fair amount of ground here. Joe lived, well, his entire adult life in the New Haven area. After going to Yale, he stayed in New Haven. In his last year, he was in a nursing home. Actually, when he gave his lutes to Yale University, he called me a few days later and said, well, I've given them away. I've given them back to the school.
And, that's wonderful.
But he was very happy about it, and he truly loved Yale, and he loved, I think he loved all his experiences in his musical life.
I'm sure he did, and he influenced so many people.
Yeah. Well, let's go out with a medley, two composers, Gasse Brulé and Bernard de Ventadorn, two composers I don't know
of
at all.
Never heard of.
They're both 1100s. Gasse Brulé is 1179 through 1212, so not a very long life there. The other one, Ventadorn, they don't know when he was born, but he died in 1195. So we will hear this medley. This is from, again, Art of the Lute by Joseph Iodone. And that will be it for today. And in future shows, we'll be talking about harpsichords, both of the revival era and historically informed performances.
Yes.
So, of course, they're both history now, but...
That's right, historically early historically informed performance.
Right, exactly. All right, so let's go out with Joseph Iodone and the Art of the Lute. Thank you.
program copyright 2009 Lyricord Discs. All rights reserved. On the next Lyricord Early and Classical Show podcast, why do those harpsichords sound so different than they used to? Nick and Jeffrey discuss the unusual path that revival harpsichords took in the early 20th century, propelled by techniques of mass production as well as the enormous popularizing of the instrument by harpsichordist Wanda Landowska.
It was on stage with her instrument. It looked like a big piano, except it had a whole rack of pedals for changing the stops. And she was a great performer. You know, she was very grand.
Performances on revival instruments are compared to performances on historically authentic instruments in favor today. Landowska's protege, harpsichordist Paul Wolf's performances on two different revival instruments highlight this episode.
Part of the thing about Paul Wolf is he's such a great player, it's almost secondary, whatever instrument.
That's right, you're drawn right in.
Don't miss the next Lyricord Early and Classical Show podcast.